Bob Oakes. Robin Young is off today. It's here and now. Two Pentagon mail facilities are closed today after letters triggered alarms and tested positive for anthrax. Pentagon officials said two letters were irradiated to kill any biological agents. Further tests are being conducted. Yesterday's alarm came on the same day a New Jersey postal facility was reopened. It had been closed for 3.5 years after it was contaminated by anthrax, a month after the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Time magazine is reporting that Jordanian terrorist Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, said to be responsible for many attacks inside Iraq, has been pondering strikes inside the United States. Adam Zagorin covers intelligence for Time magazine and was lead reporter on the story. He joins us from Washington. Adam, thanks for speaking with us.
Glad to be with you.
Adam, I'm wondering, you've learned that Zarqawi, who we think of as someone who operates most exclusively inside Iraq, may have been contemplating strikes inside the U.S. What do we know about that? First of all, what kind of strikes?
He talked about soft targets in the United States. Soft targets basically means targets that can or are difficult to defend or impossible to defend. He was thinking about hitting movie theaters, restaurants, and schools. Given that there are thousands or maybe tens of thousands in each category right there, I guess it underlines the fact of how difficult it might be to defend against such attacks were they to be launched.
Well, what are your sources basing this conclusion on?
Well, they're basing it on the interrogation of this Zarqawi aide who was captured by the United States in 2004 and remains in U.S. custody. I'm not sure where. And
or his name, right?
Or his name, correct. I do not have his name. It was not included in the security bulletin that was sent out about this subject last week.
How do people at the CIA weigh information like this that comes from an interrogation?
There's a number of intelligence agencies that would be involved in the evaluation of this. I think that there is always some doubt about anything that comes out of an interrogation unless you can, you know, very specifically verify it. And, of course, in this case, since Zarqawi has not actually launched attacks in the United States, the information is simply that he's contemplating it perhaps in some detail. On the other hand, they did think enough of this to send it out, as I indicated, in a security bulletin across the United States last week. So they must have given some credence to it.
You know, I asked the question because it's fairly easy to see a skeptic saying, yeah, Zarqawi was sitting around a table one night and fantasizing or blowing hard about attacking targets inside the U.S.
Well, I think that such skepticism is always in order when looking at intelligence reports. The other thing, of course, though, is that U.S. intelligence 2 weeks ago confirmed that Osama bin Laden has been in touch relatively recently with Zarqawi and asking him to consider attacks on the United States. So that's a completely separate, distinct and different piece of information, which in this case seems to point in more or less the same direction as the one that we developed this week in Time magazine.
Do intelligence analysts believe that Zarqawi has access to the kind of networks that he need to organize missions in the U.S.? Or did this Zarqawi aide indicate in his interrogations whether he had peoples and cells in place inside the U.S.?
Well, the United States is not aware that Zarqawi does have that capacity at the moment. And Zarqawi, by this account, seemed to be taking note of the fact that there have been essentially no major terrorist attacks in the United States for some years. And he indicated that the reason is that there is a lack of quote-unquote willing martyrs, in other words, people willing to kill themselves in the execution of one of these attacks in the United States. And he, Zarqawi, talked about, according to this account, the possibility of purchasing or bribing your way into the United States. He specifically mentioned the purchase of a visa to Honduras and then the introduction of such a person or agent into Mexico and up across the southern border of the United States.
Adam Zagorin, Washington correspondent who covers intelligence for Time magazine, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Today, both houses of Congress are hearing testimony about a series of high-profile data breaches. Last month, a company called ChoicePoint announced thieves had stolen the personal data of 145,000 people. Then LexisNexis announced that data on 30,000 people had been stolen. Executives from both firms will be testifying at today's hearings. Evan Hendricks will also be testifying. He's the editor of the newsletter Privacy Times. I asked him in advance of today's sessions to tell us about how a company such as ChoicePoint came into being.
ChoicePoint was part of Equifax. They were the division dealing in public records, and then they decided to spin off and become their own separate company. And one of the advantages to ChoicePoint, from their point of view, is they figured that they were going to be able to escape a lot of the federal laws that govern the use of personal information, like the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Because even though they were amassing information on almost every adult from public records and court records, they weren't doing it from credit granters, so they figured that was not going to be covered by the Fair Credit Reporting Act.
Why, from a corporate point of view, would it be important to be able to avoid that kind of regulation?
Because then you don't have to bother with giving people access to their own information, hearing their disputes over accuracy, having the correct information, and pretty much allows them to keep secret files that they can sell to all sorts of government agencies and businesses who use the information to make decisions about you, but you don't get to see your own information.
So just so I'm clear on this, once the information is gathered by ChoicePoint or a firm like ChoicePoint and it's stored, do you and I have access to it? I think you just said no.
ChoicePoint says they'll give you access to some of the information they keep on you, but they won't give access to you the central file they keep on you. And that's very controversial. We're not sure that that's what the law says, but that's what they say it says. So, yes, the problem is ChoicePoint will keep information on you and not let you see it.
Is there any regulation of these companies? Are they accountable under the law in some way?
Even ChoicePoint admits that some of its so-called products, the one used for tenant screening, for employment background, and for insurance claims reports, are subject to the Fair Credit Reporting Act. But in the employment and tenant screening, they say that if no landlord or employer has asked for a file on you, they don't have one. It's only if they've sold one do they have one to give you access to. And to me, that doesn't make sense.
So
you should be able to see it before they sell it to make sure it's accurate.
So in other words, they may have the information. It's just that they haven't sold it, so they say they don't have it.
Right. They say it's maybe not in a report form, but that's not what the law says. The law says if you have any information on a consumer, you got to give it to them so they can check it for accuracy.
How do government agencies use a company like ChoicePoint?
We don't know exactly how government agencies, but we do know generally that they're going to use ChoicePoint to get identifying information, location information, match it up for their investigations. But there's a lot of secrecy about the kind of information ChoicePoint actually has and what it actually sells to the government. One of the great ironies here, in order to protect our privacy, we need better sunshine about this whole process. And the secrecy makes it hard for us to know what's going on so we can protect our privacy.
So when you say we need more sunshine, you're saying we need legislation to force these companies to be more public?
Yeah, we need a combination of these upcoming congressional and state legislative hearings along with the criminal investigations to provide a full accounting of what information ChoicePoint and other companies like LexisNexis, what do they collect, how do they use it, how do they organize it and house it, and what individuals can do to ensure its accuracy and ensure its proper use.
You've written in your newsletter that the information industry is not exactly interested in trying to prevent ID theft or data theft, information theft. Why is that?
Well, as the Tower Group reported in 2003, the financial services industry still views identity theft as just a small fraction of the overall transactions. So they can't justify changing their procedures that allow identity theft to continue and to worsen. Security costs extra money, and there's really not much profit in preventing identity theft for these companies. So it's really going to have to be through public policy and enforcement of existing law if we're going to see changes.
Explain to us the market for the data that these companies house, the black market data I'm talking about. Who's interested in it and why?
Well, first of all, identity thieves are interested because they want to get people's social security number. That's the key to the kingdom, and the key moment happens when they apply for credit in your name and the credit bureau discloses your credit report to that application because they're using your social security number. Beyond that, they want to get into the databases so they can get lists of people with high credit scores, because if you're going to steal someone's identity, you want someone with a high credit score because you'll get more credit. We know why Willie Sutton robbed banks. That's where the money was. And identity thieves steal identities because they're able to get credit in people's names. And that's made possible by the disclosure of credit reports without people's consent, which is legal under current law. But they basically, if you want to steal someone's identity or you want to invade their privacy, the credit report is the first document of choice because it shows whether you have a good credit history and therefore they'll be able to get credit in your name.
Do you think that Congress is now paying attention? Do you think that the regulators are now paying attention cynically, and I flag this question as being a little cynical, because of the incident recently involving Bank of America when it announced that it lost the financial information of more than a million federal employees, including that of some U.S. senators? Boy, that's enough for lawmakers to finally sit up and take notice.
Yeah, it's always helpful when privacy problems hit close to home because then people feel them. I've seen two kinds of people, the kind that understand that invasion of privacy is very damaging and the kind that don't. The one irony here in the Bank of America case is that on the missing tape of 1.2 million customers, most of who were federal employees, was the credit card information of Senator Patrick Leahy. Senator Patrick Leahy has been one of the strongest privacy advocates in the U.S. Senate going back 20 years.
But he's not alone. 28 million Americans have been victimized in the last 5 years, according to one report that I read, which amounts to about 13% of the U.S. population and adult population. If 13% of the U.S. adult population caught the flu, there'd be outrage and a lot of concern.
Right, and this is such a slow, insidious process that it's happening and happening and you don't really notice until we get a big tsunami event like this where a lot of people are hit all at once. But that's why I think there's a very good chance of serious congressional action, because it's been building for a long time. They've tried making identity theft a crime. They've strengthened the Fair Credit Reporting Act, yet the crime continues to worsen and worsen. And now we find out about this whole new sector, which is way too unregulated, and I think that's where the next work will be done, is putting fair information practices in law to cover that sector.
Evan Hendricks is editor of Privacy Times. There's more coming up here and now. Bob Oakes, it's here and now. Continuing our conversation about security breaches, if thieves can penetrate major corporations, how vulnerable is your computer? Vijay Kanabar is Associate Professor of Computer Science at Boston University. Welcome.
You're welcome.
Let me ask you, first of all, Professor, I think we all know that crooks are getting better at hacking and scamming and breaking down doors or opening up computers. And I'm wondering what some of the scams that personal computers are likely to find themselves victimized by.
The key concerns I have are social engineering, number one. With social engineering, what happens is you get a spam or you get an email. It appears legitimate. What happens here is they are trying to solicit information from you. They're trying to get your username. They're trying to get your password. They're trying to get credit card information. I've seen it all. That's the number one major concern in the country right now.
You call it social engineering because?
It's a technical word to describe the process of trying to steal information from you in a friendly or apparently legitimate way. For example, you may get a phone call from saying that, you know, Bob, I'm Boston University technical support. We are giving you a new operating system. Can you give me your username password? They may not ask for both at the same time. They may say, can you give me your username? And they may call in some other time and say, okay, I don't need your username. I just need your password. So those are all social engineering techniques. They include even things like dumpster diving, going into a trash can to see if they can pull out any information, your user email address, account, anything.
You brought a laptop in with you. You fired it up. Let's take a look at that letter that was in an email that you've recently received. Right. The letter purports to be
yes.
From PayPal, the online service that helps you pay for the things you purchase, most especially from eBay, if you're
That's
an
right.
eBay user. What's the letter say?
Dear PayPal, your account has been randomly flagged in our system as part of a routine security measure. This is a must to ensure that only you have access to your PayPal account. And to ensure a safe PayPal experience, we require all flagged accounts to verify their information with us. To verify, please click on the hyperlink below.
So, in other words, they're looking for your information.
That's right.
And while it looks like it's from PayPal, it's not.
No, it's not. It's from a hacker.
And if you didn't know better and you clicked on that hyperlink, what would happen?
One thing is they would immediately install something called Trojan Horse. It's a program that potentially the hacker can control. In this particular case, I tried this out on a safe computer. This is what happened. I saw the Trojan Horse, which my antivirus detected immediately and quarantined, thankfully. And the second thing that happened is it took me to a phony PayPal site, which looks like the real PayPal site. And it's saying, please enter your email address, please enter your password. And as soon as anyone does that, they have essentially given away their PayPal account to a hacker who could then transfer money to themselves.
Now, for those not familiar with PayPal on the other end of the radio out there, if you give away your email address and your password, the hacker will now potentially have access to your bank account because your bank account is typically linked to PayPal or a legitimate or many legitimate credit cards.
Quite frequently, in my case, it's linked to a credit card.
If you didn't know better, and you click through those hyperlinks, your pocket was just picked.
That's right, exactly.
Okay, is there something else you want to show us on here?
I wanted to show basically just how easy it is then to what we call guess passwords as well. Another thing that people may make a mistake is they leave their computer open for a while or they step away for a few minutes. This is quite common in large corporations. What a hacker could do is basically do what I've just what I have here is just download a program that allows someone to detect all the passwords that are there in your computer and essentially control the computer later on from home if he or she wants to.
Right, you're in the process right now of downloading a password cracking program.
Program, that's right, and these are available for free. Many are free and many are trial 21-day editions. Here we go. So what we have now is a program called Windows Security Explorer. It's a 30-day trial version, but all I need is a few minutes with it, and we are done. In 1 minute, I have already detected the password for Professor, the account called Professor, and within a millionth of a second, it's able to tell me that the password is P-R-O-F-E-S-S.
We should say we're not doing this for real right now. We're not trying to hack into anyone's computer.
No,
but just
the
program.
PC, yeah.
But that program could be at a major university or a major corporation.
Once they are on a local area network, they can access any of the thousands of computers, and potentially target any of those machines by simply specifying their IP address or their address. and then simply doing something called a brute force attack. Brute force attack will go through every combination, every letter, everything, and 13 hours, 14 hours, 20 hours later, you would have the password for that particular computer, and the hacker can just, intruder can just take control of your computer. In my machine here, for example, even though the password is pretty long, like Professor had a password, it's able to immediately crack this. Letters 1 to 7, Profess, letters 0 to 14, OR, it's cracked the password Professor, because Professor belongs in a dictionary, and it does a dictionary crack so quickly. It's very important that people know that passwords should be pretty strong.
Random numbers, random letters should absolutely not spell a word, is what you're
saying.
That's
right, and you should even use strange symbols like exclamation. You should use bizarre symbols as well. Those would be even stronger for protecting your computer.
Professor Kanabar, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Vijay Kanabar is professor of computer science at Boston University. By the way, the firm ChoicePoint said they would not provide us with a spokesperson in time for today's show. Stay with us. There is more ahead, here and now. I'm Bob Oakes, in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The president of Kosovo has survived an apparent assassination attempt. A bomb exploded as President Ibrahim Rugova's motorcade was driving through the provincial capital of Pristina. He was on his way to a meeting with a representative of the European Union. Joining us on the line from Pristina is Agron Bayrami, editor of the daily newspaper Koha Ditori. Welcome, Agron.
Hi.
Agron, tell us what happened this morning.
Well, apparently there was an attack on the cars which were transporting the president of Kosovo to the meeting with European Union's representative Javier Solana. The attack happened right after 8 in the morning. It was in the middle of the city, at the center of the city, and we still don't know who might be the possible attackers or who planted the bomb, which exploded in a garbage container. There were two passers-by apparently hurt, but the president, he is in good shape.
Just to reiterate, President Rugova escaped injury.
Yes.
What's been the immediate reaction from the people in Kosovo to this attack?
Well, there's been enormous reaction from various political parties and NGOs and people in general who were disgusted with this kind of thing happening. There seems to be this attempt to destabilize the country, so everybody is unhappy and very enraged with this kind of thing happening.
Rugova said after the attack something to the effect of, unfortunately, there are still elements which want to destabilize Kosovo. Who would stand to gain the most from this attack, do you think?
Well, I think that people who are not interested in having a more democratic and more open society being created here, people who would be involved into trafficking and such criminal activity would not want to have a stable and politically solved Kosovo. So I think that that kind of people would be prepared to destabilize the country.
I think this leads to the obvious question, Agron. How stable is Kosovo politically?
Well, I think that politically it is more stable than it was ever after the war. What we are facing now is the need to have more sustainable institutions of law and order and sustainable institutions of the state in general in order to guard this political process from being destabilized.
Agron, have things become less stable in Kosovo in the last week since the resignation of the former Prime Minister Ramush Haradinaj, who resigned to face war crime charges at The Hague?
Well, I think they are not as tense as people have expected them to be. I think that we have to thank him for that because he dealt with the situation quite bravely in the eyes of the people here. And he was the one factor who actually diffused the possible tensions which might occur after his departure. So I think that we are a much more calmer place than probably most of the world would think of us.
Agron Bayrami, editor of the daily newspaper, Koha Ditori, thank you very much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you too, Bob.
Now we turn to Beth Kampscher, freelance journalist who covers the Balkans, who joins us on the line from Sarajevo, the capital of Bosnia and Herzegovina. Hi, Beth.
Hi, Bob. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Do me a favor first and remind listeners about the political status of Kosovo.
Basically, what we're looking at is that Kosovo has been administered by the UN since 1999 after the NATO-led bombing drove Serbian forces from the province, but it's still technically part of Serbia. And the majority Albanians there are hankering for the province to become independent.
As we mentioned earlier, the attack comes as the former Prime Minister, Haradinaj, faces war crime charges at The Hague. How has that affected the security and stability of Kosovo?
Late last week when I was there, there were increased military checkpoints on roads and highways, and NATO had reinforcements sent in, about 500 or 600 troops from Germany, about the same number from Britain, and I believe some 70 Italian peacekeepers were flown in from nearby Bosnia.
Well, why did he turn himself in?
I interviewed him a few weeks ago, and he seemed to be confident that there was no case against him and that these were only allegations. But the significance in this is that it is in the surrender, because he's shown that the highest-ranking Kosovar Albanian indicted by the tribunal is willing to go and answer the charges immediately after being indicted, whereas high-ranking Serbs who were indicted, let's say, 10 years ago, have yet to appear or even to be arrested by their respective governments.
I guess based on what he told you, he feels he's innocent, or at least the prosecutors can't prove that he's guilty. But is there a political motive here on his part?
The province has been in limbo for the last couple of years. Like I said, it's run by the UN, but it's technically part of Serbia. And the Albanians want independence, and they have to come up with certain standards before they will be granted independence, let's say, by the international community. And so it's significant that he's willing to go to The Hague to answer to these charges. He's trying to keep things under control there, it seems.
There's also been more cooperation between The Hague and other countries in the Balkans. What are some of the recent developments?
I would say the most recent development has been, I think it's about 9 Serb who have voluntarily surrendered and turn themselves in to either the local authorities to be sent to The Hague or to peacekeeping troops. But we have to keep in mind that these are surrenders rather than actual arrests made by the local authorities, because it's just not politically feasible for, let's say, the Serbian government to arrest some of these people because of wartime media propaganda. A lot of these guys are considered heroes, and it's pretty much political suicide for these politicians to order arrests. And it could turn out to be personally suicidal as well, because if you remember 2 years ago, we saw the Serbian Prime Minister Zoran Djindjic get gunned down in downtown Belgrade, and part of the reason was because of his willingness to cooperate with the tribunal.
And we should also point out that 2 of the most wanted war criminals in Bosnia remain at large all these years later.
We have former Bosnian Serb military general Ratko Mladic and his political counterpart Radovan Karadzic, they were indicted in 1995, and there's no sign of them in The Hague yet.
In the Balkans, there's a lot of talk about joining Europe. Will these countries, do you think, be able to move along down that road if these suspected war criminals remain at large?
Oh, absolutely not. On the one hand, the European Union is becoming more stringent about its requirements, and the Union wants to see reforms and things like this done before they'll open talks. And the war criminals issue is a major sticking point here. I mean, we look at what's happening in Croatia right now. They're facing, I think it's tomorrow or Thursday, they'll be getting an official answer from the EU about whether they can even open the talks on the 17th of March, because they haven't turned over one of their former generals. And the other thing to point out is that, you know, these wars ended almost 10 years ago, but there will be little or no moving on from the leftovers of the conflicts until these criminals face justice.
Beth Kampscher, freelance journalist who covers the Balkans, who's written for the Christian Science Monitor, joins us on the line from Sarajevo. Beth, thanks.
Thank you very much.
Still to come, the works of the horror writer H.P. Lovecraft. You're listening to Here and Now. The company at the heart of a college admissions hacking controversy is looking into whether it should take legal action. ApplyYourself.com is a Virginia-based website that's used by many of the nation's elite business schools for admissions processes. 2 weeks ago, a computer hacker gained access into supposedly secure networks, and some business school applicants followed suit to try and get an early peek at their admissions decisions. At least six business schools are affected, and three, Harvard, MIT, and Carnegie Mellon, said last week they will reject any applicants who access their pages. I asked Randy Cohen, who writes The Ethicist, a weekly syndicated column for the New York Times Magazine, if he thought Harvard, MIT, and Carnegie Mellon were overreacting in their response to the controversy.
I think overreacting is understating. I think they're posturing. I think they're bloviating. I think punishments have to be proportional to the transgressions. And this seems unclear if these kids even did commit a transgression. They harmed no one. They didn't rummage around in anybody's files. I'll concede that you could regard this as a transgression, but if so, a minor one. It's as if they snuck into a swimming pool. And to block their admission to the school seems ultimately like a form of bragging, because isn't what's implied in that is to say that this action is wildly different than what goes on at Harvard, and I just don't believe that's true.
But assuming they did it, these kids hacked their way into a website. How is that not improper?
I'm willing to concede that it's an impropriety, but I think we should avoid using charged words like hacked if we want to really understand what they did. They perhaps cleverly gained entrance, and they gained entrance to information that Harvard didn't want them to see for another, what, another week, another 2 weeks? But hack makes it seem like they broke through some security protections, they rummaged around in files, they changed things. They didn't. How is that different than if someone had tiptoed into the dean's office and sort of looked at the papers that said they were accepted or not? I grant it's a transgression.
Well, that would be breaking and entering.
Well, let's say the door was open and they walked in because these kids kind of walked in. They didn't break and enter into anything. I concede that what they did is something they ought not have done, but if you're going to design punishments, they have to be proportional to the wrongdoing. And this seems wildly disproportional.
Reading from Harvard's statement, Randy, our mission is to educate principled leaders who make a difference in the world. To achieve that, a person must have many skills and qualities, including the highest standards of integrity, sound judgment, and a strong moral compass, an intuitive sense of what's right and what's wrong. Those who hacked into this website have failed to pass that test. Your response?
Bragging. Sheer bragging. I've never seen any evidence that suggested that the graduates of Harvard Business School are more virtuous than other members of the business community or the general community. They're using the punishment of these kids as a form of boasting about their own ethics, and that's just dishonest.
Do you think that these decisions then are being driven by all the controversies in the business world, the scandals involving Enron and Tyco, the prominent trials of a very well-known chief executives?
I could well understand why those in the business community are particularly sensitive to charges about their ethics, but to respond by being particularly harsh on the least powerful members of the community seems to me profoundly unethical.
But you don't expect Harvard, MIT, Carnegie Mellon to change their decisions, do you?
Well, I would hope they would see the light. I would hope they listen to your show and go, you know, I'm thinking of this in a new way, and we've really overreacted here. They should respond to these kids doing this. They should make it clear that it's unacceptable, that these applicants acted wrong. No question. But how do you respond to that? Maybe you say, well, you don't get to come in till next term. Maybe you say you come in and you're immediately on some kind of academic probation. It's fine for them to respond, and it's fine for them to make it clear that this behavior is out of line. But, you know, in England by 1830, there were more than 200 capital crimes, and they could argue, those that defended that approach to justice argued that, well, you know, if we kill you for stealing bread, we make it clear that we don't tolerate bread stealing. That wasn't an ethical justice system, and it wasn't a particularly effective one. I think Harvard is, well, they're not actually hanging them, but they are acting rather severely.
Randy Cohen, thank you.
It's a pleasure.
Randy Cohen writes The Ethicist, a weekly syndicated column for the New York Times Magazine, and answers listeners' ethics questions on Weekend All Things Considered. Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now. I'm Bob Oakes. It's Here and Now. The pantheon of American horror writers begins with Edgar Allan Poe and ends at the moment with Stephen King. Sandwiched in between the two, H.P. Lovecraft, who in the 1920s and 30s wrote tales of horror for popular magazines aimed at teenage boys. To some critics, Lovecraft's over-the-top writing encouraged the worst in horror fiction and films. For others, such as best-selling horror novelist Peter Straub, Lovecraft is a master. Straub edited a volume of Lovecraft stories for the Library of America. Here, Straub reads from the tale, The Dunwich Horror.
When a traveler in north-central Massachusetts takes the wrong fork at the junction of the Aylesbury Pike just beyond Dean's Corners, he comes upon a lonely and curious country. The ground gets higher, and the briar-bordered stone walls press closer and closer against the ruts of the dusty, curving road. The trees of the frequent forest belts seem too large, and the wild weeds, brambles, and grasses attain a luxuriance not often found in settled regions. At the same time, the planted fields appear singularly few and barren, while the sparsely scattered houses wear a surprisingly uniform aspect of age, squalor, and dilapidation.
Recently, Here and Now's critic Bill Marks reviewed the book unfavorably and spoke to Peter Straub about horror writer H.P. Lovecraft.
Why did you place Lovecraft in the history of horror? How does he compare, let's say, to Edgar Allan Poe or the Gothic writers?
He's in that line, and he's the most significant writer to follow Charles Brockden Brown and Poe. He's the only survivor, I think, of the pulp era in this field, the way Chandler and Hammett are the strongest survivors of the other sorts of pulps.
And how was he viewed as a writer in his day? Did they accept him as a giant of horror?
His peers did. He was really only published in magazines like Weird Tales and Astounding Tales. The other writers trying to get published in those pulp magazines saw something very powerful, really cherished him, and he formed a very close set of friendships with him. Beyond that world, however, I think he was largely unknown. The more serious, so-called, literary world paid attention to him was devastatingly after his death when Edmund Wilson wrote an essay that, in effect, trashed him and said that the only horrors here are the horrors of bad imagination and bad writing.
Well, I must admit that doesn't sound like a bad point about Lovecraft to me. To someone who thinks that that's true, and that in many ways, by celebrating Lovecraft, you're also, in a sense, encouraging some of the worst things that we've seen in horror writing and also in horror films. You know, the sort of the excessive, the march into ever more excessive, indescribable, horrible things.
I think that's a really crazy point of view. His writing is certainly basically restrained. It is true that he never met an adjective he didn't like. He had the autodidact's typical fault of being in love with long words. And he also had a flaw that he invented all on his own. When young, he thought of himself as an old man properly at home in the 18th century. And so there are certain quirks of style that come directly from this purely defensive pose. His stories are rather slow-moving. I think that's one of the good things about them. He really has next to no connection with the kind of movie that you were alluding to before.
And a lot of his stories, I mean, let's face it, people turn into pools of goo under the influence of incredible, horrible, his sort of mythological monsters. So, I mean, certainly that anticipates, in a sense, the unmentionable horrors of that sort of human meltdown is then created visually in many of the horror films we see today. I mean, they're basically just taking a cue from him and visualizing it.
I wish we did see stuff like that in contemporary horror films. The kind of thing that I associate with most horror films, at least until very, very recently, is a lot of teenagers getting impaled on various sharp objects and, in effect, being punished for sexual behavior in increasingly macabre and grotesque ways. There isn't anything like that in Lovecraft.
Well, what do you see as his influence on contemporary horror?
He has been, for decades, a kind of pervasive influence. And he is sort of a grandfather to a great many people because of the atmosphere that he could create, an atmosphere really of increasing dread, which is very useful if you're going to write horror, and that panoply of old gods that he invented.
Let me ask a little bit more about, because there are a lot of people who admire Lovecraft and compare him to someone like Tolkien, to the extent that with the old gods that he created,
right.
he was creating his own, before Tolkien, creating a mythological world, in this case, made up of pagan gods rather than the Judeo-Christian tradition. In that sense, he anticipates a lot of what's going on in contemporary horror films, contemporary yeah. horror, because he shoves the Christian Judeo tradition aside and comes up
right.
with something different.
I agree with that completely. He did create a secondary world. I would also say that Conan Doyle did, in effect, with the creation of Sherlock Holmes, who was virtually a secondary world all his own.
Let me just read. I'd like to read a passage here in terms of Lovecraft's style and mm-hmm. his creating a sense of tension. I'll just start. It's just a short passage here. This is, as usual, one of his stories. Someone is going descending down a very dark stairway and into the unknown. There was a sort of heavy dragging and a most detestably sticky noise, as of some fiendish and unclean species of suction. With an associative sense goaded to feverish heights, he thought unaccountably of what he had seen upstairs. Good God, what eldritch dream world was this into which he had blundered? We then go on through the rest of the paragraph, you know, talking more about, you know, the blundering with, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, to me, that's not suspense. I mean, to me, that verges on parody.
Well, that is a pretty typical passage for that sort of moment in these stories. I think there is a deal of tension in there. Whenever people begin to descend staircases, something always gets ramped up in the reader. And Lovecraft here was taking advantage of that phenomenon. It's a little overripe.
Now, what would you like this volume to do for H.P. Lovecraft?
What I would hope for has already happened. That is, his inclusion in the Library of America amounts to an acceptance into the most respected form of the canon, which is the Library of America. It preserves the writers that it thinks that are the writers most to be valued in the history of our writing. It's gotten a lot of very thoughtful reviews, and I think the only really harsh review it had was yours.
Well, there's
which struck me. struck me as a kind of old-fashioned viewpoint. And when I had to read through a lot of Lovecraft, all at one go, he surprised me by being a much better writer than I had remembered. And in some sense, in some strange, unique sense, I think he's a great American writer. It would be fatal to imitate him. You'd be terrible.
On that, we agree wholeheartedly.
Yeah, we do.
Thanks so much for talking to me.
My pleasure.
Horror novelist Peter Straub speaking to Here and Now's Bill Marks about Library of America's volume of H.P. Lovecraft. For more information and to read Bill Marks's review, check our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Matt Largy, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George, and our interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. I'm Bob Oakes. Join us again, Here and Now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.